And welcome tonight to CCL's training on the legislative details and textual analysis and understanding the monumental Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. I'm your host, Brett Cease, Citizen Climate Lobby's Volunteer Education and Engagement Coordinator, and I want to thank you personally for joining us tonight. I think I like to think of tonight's story as CCL's equivalent to VH1's Behind the Music series, if you can remember that, where Danny is going to walk us through the legislative text by giving us a little bit of a backstory on how we did the same thing with congressional offices. So to do that, our speaker is the wonderful CCL Vice President of Government Affairs, Dr. Danny Richter. After 5 years as a volunteer and finishing his PhD from the Scripps Institute and doing research across the world, Danny joined CCL staff in 2013 as the first staffer in D.C., where he established that office, and since has been responsible for developing our overall legislative strategy, clarifying the details of our policy, and overseeing our research program while interacting with a lot of the other big green groups throughout D.C. And for tonight's focus, if we've done our job well, you can expect the following. We're going to do a section-by-section analysis of the bill details, and while we do that, Danny will pull out specific text, examples from the actual legislation and that language, and walk you through that to really field a lot of the questions that we've been getting in the forums and throughout a lot of our interactions. And then after that, we'll have a chance to do a more robust Q&A for anything that we missed. And I'll also just say this, and I'll put this in the chat window as well. If you are curious about where we are referring to this section by section analysis tonight, it is in the resources tab of the main page on community for the Energy Innovation Act. And you can see there on the left-hand side under the general tab of section by section analysis, you can see this helpful resource that Danny and the DC office have been using as a breakdown of analyzing the actual bill text. So without further ado, Danny, I will pass the baton to you.
All right. Thank you so much, Brett. As always, you do a great job of queuing us up. And it's a pleasure to be here with everybody. So as Brett said, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be going through the section by section of the bill. And so this document, which is available to you on CCL Community, that was the slide that we just showed, right here. This is very close to what we were using to shop this around to members of Congress on the Hill. So we would take the section by section that is available right there on Community. That would be the template that we would go off of in offices. And now you have it. It just goes through all the different sections of the bill. And so when I was going through this with congressional offices, it would take about 45 minutes to go through all of the sections. But I also, for you, the CCL volunteers, I want to go into the text. So I'm going to skip around a little bit, or not skip around, but skip certain sections, and really look at key parts of the text that I might have highlighted in those meetings, or that I think show something really important about the text, something that echoes the CCL message. So we're going to be doing a detailed textual analysis. And the first section in that section by section actually is just the introduction. So it's the legislation title and background. So just a reminder, the bill has been submitted. It was assigned a bill number of 7173. And as of today, it has three Republicans and five Democrats. Judy Chu, who is a member of the Ways and Means Committee, one of the three committees of jurisdiction for this bill, joined on as a Democrat. So that's very exciting. In the new Congress, the plan is to resubmit. It will be resubmitted early in the next Congress, I think as early as January, but as Brett said, kind of behind the scenes, Legislative Council took a really long time to draft this text for us. So it could be longer, but the goal is to introduce it as early as possible. And it would be assigned a new bill number in the new Congress. So I think all of the co-sponsors who are coming back, who are not retiring, do intend to be on this bill. It will have a new bill number. So that was section one. Section two, this is just the findings and context. In the section by section, we highlight just what is this doing? There's a heavy emphasis on markets. So as you can imagine, I was going through talking to Republicans and I was highlighting that this is intended to incentivize innovation to make markets more efficient. But here in our more public messaging, we want to emphasize these 5 points: that this bill will be effective, this bill will create jobs, this bill is going to be good for people. It's going to save lives, or you can go back to the jobs element. It's bipartisan. The first time it was introduced, it had both Democratic and Republican support, and it is revenue neutral. So these are the things that we want to highlight. And so feel free to highlight what's in the section by section, or to highlight these five high-level messaging points, which we want to come back to again and again. Now, section three, this is where you get into the different, the real nitty gritty of the bill. And so the parts that I want to highlight for you, the textual analysis, this is the first one, and this is the fee. So in section 9902 of the bill text, page 9, line 12, we have, in general, the carbon-free rate with respect to any use, sale, or transfer during a calendar year shall be, in the case of the year calendar 2019, $15, and be except as provided in paragraph 2. In the case of any calendar year thereafter, the carbon fee rate in effect under the subsection for the preceding calendar year plus $10. So it's basically saying whatever it was last year plus $10. And it does highlight an exemption, and that exemption, the first exemption, actually is to make the bill stronger. So this is the first exception. So the increased carbon fee rate after a missed annual emissions reduction target, in the case of any year immediately following a year for which the Secretary determines under 9903B, and I'll cover 9903B a little bit later, that the actual emissions of greenhouse gases from covered fuels exceeded the emissions reductions target for the previous year, paragraph 1B shall be substituted by $15 for $10. So if you'll remember this previous one here, this is B, it's just saying that if we're not meeting our targets, if we're not meeting the emissions schedule, if we're not meeting the schedule of emissions reductions that get us to a 90% reduction below 2015 levels by 2050, then instead of increasing by $10, we'll be increasing by $15. So, you know, if you signed up for a textual analysis of bill, I expect that you're on board with this kind of detail. So I'm just going to operate under that assumption, and we're just going to keep on rolling by this. So that's the fee. This is the first exemption, and it makes it actually stronger, saying if we're not meeting those targets, this is what we call the environmental integrity mechanism. And so this is the environmental integrity mechanism. And then this part maps exactly to the CCL proposal that we've been talking about all these years. The fee will stop increasing once we have achieved certain emissions reductions. So in the case of any year immediately following a year for the secretary, and the secretary here refers to the Secretary of the Treasury. This is amending the tax code. So the secretary throughout the bill refers to the Secretary of the Treasury, for which the secretary determines under 9903B that actual emissions of greenhouse gases from covered fuels is not more than 10% of the greenhouse gas emissions from covered fuels during the year 2015, paragraph 1B shall be applied by substituting zero for $10. So remember, paragraph 1B, that was just the escalator. So that was just saying it increases by $10 per ton. So by substituting zero, we're not zeroing out the carbon fee. What we are doing is we're zeroing out the rate of increase. So this text, what it all does is it keeps the rate, the carbon fee constant. So this is the complicated legalese way of keeping the rate of increase constant. Now, here is the schedule for emissions reductions, and this is what's in section 9903. So this is what the environmental integrity mechanism links to. And remember, the environmental integrity mechanism was the piece that ratchets it up to $15 increase per year instead of $10 if we're not meeting those emissions reductions target. And this table actually has caused some confusion. And so we are recommending some updates to this table when the bill is resubmitted. So the points of confusion here, you see 2022 to 2030, and then you see 2030 again. That should probably be 2031. And this says 2040, and that says this should say 2041. So we are cleaning that up. Another thing that has to be updated when we reintroduce this is this schedule will not get us to a 90% reduction below 2015 emissions anymore. And so we are recommending to the Deutsche office that instead of 2015, the reference year be 2016. And we're also recommending a choice of schedules that still get us to a 90% reduction below 2016 emissions. And the reason we're going from 2015 to 2016 is because when we started drafting, again, taking the cover back on the process here, when we started drafting the most recent U.S. inventory of greenhouse gas emissions, this is an annual publication by the EPA, the most recent year was 2015. Now it is 2016. And so that's why I say 2016. There are parts in the text that specifically anchor the methodology and the emissions reductions to that annual publication by the EPA. So that's why we're doing that. So this is the schedule for emissions reductions. And this next part is talking about when would the fee, decommissioning of the carbon fee. Sorry about that. So in general, at such time that the secretary determines under 9903B, so that's the schedule of emissions reductions, that actual green emissions of greenhouse gases from covered fuels is not more than 10% of the greenhouse gas emissions from covered fuels during the year 2015, and the monthly carbon dividend payable to an adult eligible individual has been less than $20 for three consecutive years, then the fee shall be decommissioned. So what this is the sunset clause. So we set the fee, we enabled it to be ratcheted up more quickly, we went over the pause. This is saying that once we've achieved our emissions, once we've achieved these goals, and once the monthly dividend is so small that it is $20 per ton, $20 in the dividend, monthly dividend per individual per month for three consecutive years, at that point we decommission the fee. And what we are doing here is we're basically saying gradual ramp up, pause, gradual ramp down. And so in order for the fee, the dividend to be $20 for three consecutive years, we're basically not burning any fossil fuels anymore. And so we should be way, way, way below this target. And there should have been a weaning off of fossil fuels by the population. So in the negotiation process, there was a concern raised by the offices that people would become dependent on the dividend, and that if you were to take it away too quickly, then there would be anger in the streets. And so by linking these two provisions, you make sure that this is a ramp up, pause, ramp down, and everybody, you know, wean people on, wean people off. At that point, we shouldn't be burning any fossil fuels. So we achieve the climate goals, and then we have a positive social impact. So that's what that is. And then the next part here is where are we actually assessing the fee? And what this says, so this is section 9907, the identification of an effective point in the production, distribution, or use of a covered fuel or fluorinated greenhouse gas for collecting such carbon fee or fluorinated greenhouse gas fee in such a manner so as to minimize administrative burden and maximize the extent to which full fuel cycle greenhouse gas emissions from covered fuels or fluorinated greenhouse gases have the carbon fee or fluorinated greenhouse gas fee levied upon them. So again, this is what you get when you read the legislative text. But the purpose of this is just to say, we are not going to identify in this bill text exactly where it makes the most sense to collect the fee, but Congress is instructing regulators to minimize the administrative burden and maximize the coverage. So we want to find those choke points in the supply chain of fossil fuels where we can get as many fossil fuels as possible with the least administrative burden. So this is an important selling point that we would highlight as we're going to offices. It was a common concern how many entities would be covered. And so we highlighted this in the text. We were able to cover it into the text. And another thing I'll highlight here, there were a lot of jargony phrases. So covered fuel, fluorinated greenhouse gas, full fuel cycle greenhouse gas emissions. All those things are defined in the definitions section of this document. And the definitions, the way we constructed this, we were trying to keep it tight. We were trying to keep it as few pages as possible. And the way we tried to accomplish that was actually kicking out a lot of legislating to the definitions. So when we were going out to legislative offices, when we were familiarizing with this text, I would actually say you should really spend a good amount of time on the definitions and reading the definitions, because there's a lot of detail in those definitions that applied throughout the text. It means that we thought we could make it shorter and more concise. So if you do want to take upon yourself to read this entire text, I'm going to give you the same advice I gave to congressional offices. Spend a good amount of time on the definitions. There's a lot in there, and internalizing them will enable you to make a lot more sense out of the rest of the text. So this is another thing that we're now moving on to the border carbon adjustment. And so this one, when I was going through and talking with offices, I kept this pretty high level. And I think if you go through the section by section, you will see that that language is also pretty high level. We really just highlighting the intent is to keep everything even, Stephen. Carbon intensive goods or fossil fuels that are coming in have the carbon fee or the border carbon adjustment applied to them. Fossil fuels that are exported or carbon intensive goods that are exported have the carbon fee or the border carbon adjustment rebated to them in a fair and equivalent way that is intended to preserve national treatment and most favored nation. Those are two key terms that refer to the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades. They are very important terms in the legal parlance. But as we were going through this, staffers who were ahead of the game, they would highlight this second paragraph of Section 9908 because it sounded kind of weird to them. And so what I did is I would start going in there. I would have my section by section. I would have the full bill text. And I would actually read this purpose. The purpose of the carbon border fee adjustment is to protect animal, plant, and human life and health, to conserve exhaustible natural resources by preventing carbon leakage, and to facilitate the creation of international agreements. So those advanced staffers who are doing their homework reading this, they would actually highlight this for me and say, what is this? This is weird. So this paragraph would jar them. But what this paragraph does is it echoes almost exactly language from that GATT, that General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades. So those of you who have really studied their CCL laser talks will remember that in one of the laser talks on the WTO, we say this is designed to be compatible with most favored nation and natural treatment, but In the case of on a technicality, we're not in alignment with those. Article 20, subparagraphs B and G of the GATT say that you can, if the purpose is to protect animal, plant, and human life and health, to conserve exhaustible natural resources, then you can still do this. And so this is just covering our butts. This paragraph is entirely to make it obvious that we are trying to be good citizens with the WTO, good partners in the WTO, and this enables us to access those loopholes under Article 20, subparagraphs B and G, if on a technicality the WTO determined that for some reason we violated national treatment or most favored nation. So that's the only purpose of this paragraph. And offices, as I was sharing that, they really appreciated knowing that, and they were able to really appreciate this, even when they highlighted as kind of standing out. So the next section, and the section by section, is the carbon dividend trust fund. So this is the dividend part. And this first one, this is where the we talk about the capping of the administrative expenses. So many of you, as you've lobbied, you know that administrative expenses have been a big concern. And so this is the language that caps the administrative expenses. So much of the expenses necessary to administer the carbon dividend trust fund each year as does not exceed, A, in the case of the first 5 calendar years, ending after the date of the enactment of this section, the administrative expenses for any year may not exceed 8% of amounts appropriated to the carbon dividend trust fund during such year, and B, in the case of any calendar thereafter, 2% of the 5-year rolling average of the amounts appropriated to the carbon dividend trust fund. So as we were crafting this text, we were already armed with the dividend delivery study, Alan Lerman's study, which he did for us, and that included a very rough estimate of administrative costs. And that amounted to about 8% of total first year costs. And we really didn't want to, we wanted to keep administrative costs low. And we also wanted to have language in there that enables members of Congress to say, look, this bill is not going to expand the size of government, where this is not crazy government overreach. We have language in there that keeps this under control. And that's what this language is. So we wanted to be realistic in terms of, we wanted to be able to set up the administration, but we didn't want to, but we also wanted to cap it long-term. And so those of you who have read our administrative cost laser talks know that it asymptotes out as the revenues continue increasing. The costs will remain relatively fixed at around, our estimate I think is $4.5 billion per year. And so we start off, I think, just below 8, and then we get down to, it asymptotes out to 1. And so these numbers make sure that those first 5 years we can set it up while the revenues are going to be relatively low. And then after that, less than 2. And if for whatever reason there is some spike in administrative costs, we have that 5-year rolling average so that we're able to say we're controlling costs, but nonetheless, we should be able to set this up. So a lot of thought went into crafting these few paragraphs. It's a really great talking point for members of Congress, saying we are controlling costs here, and we feel very confident that this is going to still enable us to execute the program, the dividend portion, successfully. So the next point here, the eligible individual. The eligible individual means, with respect to any month, any natural living person who has a valid Social Security number or taxpayer identification number and is a citizen or lawful resident of the United States, parentheses, other than any individual who is a citizen of any possession of the United States and whose bona fide residence is outside the United States, the Secretary is authorized to verify the individual's eligibility to receive a carbon dividend payment. So let's break this down. Natural living person. As we were crafting this, there was a concern that because corporations are persons under law, we didn't want this going to corporations, so we wanted to say natural living person. We wanted to be clear that this was just to regular people, not corporations. And then in the CCL construction, we wanted this to go to all residents. And so some of that is here, not to citizens, but to all residents, valid social security number, taxpayer identification number. You can be here and not be a citizen, and you can have one of those, and you can get the dividend. But as it went through the legislative process, we were not able to get this to all residents. So undocumented residents, we were not able to figure out a way to get this to undocumented residents. To get the dividend, you have to be found. And unfortunately, with our current illogical immigration system, it creates an incentive for people who are not here with documents to be found. And so we remain open, absolutely, we remain open to ways to figure out how to get undocumented migrants a dividend. But up until this point, we haven't seen anything. So we are interested, but this is what the text says. We tried to be as broad, so not just a social security number, but also a tax identification number as possible, not just citizens, but also lawful residents. But that's as far as we could take it. For the possessions, that's for the territories of the United States. And we wanted to... It's kind of footballed to a couple of different constructions, but where the legislators landed was because a lot of those are islands, no fee and no dividend. So the residents of those islands would not be subject to a fee because there would have to be some sort of border adjustment for those. But they don't pay the fee, but they don't get the dividend. There also would have been problems on the dividend. So in this construction, in this version, it's just they're not subject to the fee. They're not subject to the dividend. What about the social safety net program? So also through the dividend delivery study, Alan Lerman alerted us. The dividend is taxable, and the reason the dividend is taxable is that's the only reason this is revenue neutral. If the dividend is not taxable, this is not revenue neutral. But Alan Lerman pointed out, because of the benefits that people receive, and some of them are means tested, if you make the dividend taxable income, then people could be kicked off of those. They could go past certain thresholds, and they could actually lose in the value of benefits as much as they're gaining in the dividend. And of course, that is not the intention of the program. The intention of the program is to make sure that exactly those people are winners. Those people who need those benefits, we want to make sure they keep those benefits. And so this language was added in there. Federal programs and federal assisted programs, the carbon dividend amount received by any individual shall not be taken into account as income, and shall not be taken into account as resources for purposes of determining the eligibility of such individual or any other individual for benefits or assistance, or the amount or extent of benefits or assistance under any federal program or under any state or local program financed in whole or in part with federal funds. So people get benefits both from the federal government and from the state and from their local governments. This is a federal bill. So we just wanted to make sure that if they're getting federal money, that doesn't count. And this just makes sure that a maximum number of people who we really want to receive the dividend do, in fact, receive the full value of their dividend, and there isn't some trade-off with the dividend kicking them off of means-tested programs that they need. So this is language we went out of our way to protect those who really need to benefit from the dividend. All right, section 6 and 7 of the section by section. These are two studies. These are kind of supplementary environmental integrity mechanisms. And where these came from, as we were sharing the text and running it by different environmental organizations, they had some concerns about the fundamental economics of all economists say carbon fees will work, but they thought, well, just in case they don't, let's add these studies in there And so section six is a study to see if the fee is working as it is intended to, and then to make non-binding recommendations to legislators on how to improve the program. And then section seven is a comparable study about biomass use in other carbon sinks. So this is a fee only on fossil fuels. And so it could provide an incentive to burn biomass more, and that could be a problem. And so this is a study to explicitly to keep that on the radar and say, look, this could create a problem. It could create a perverse incentive to there are good ways of burning biomass and there are bad ways. Let's not lose track of this. Let's do a study. Let's figure out how this is working and make recommendations about how to fix the any problems. So these are two other supplementary environmental integrity mechanisms just to make sure that the economics are working the way we think they should. Now, section eight, this is the regulatory pause, adjustments to duplicative greenhouse gas regulation. And this section was the price of making this a bipartisan bill. It became very clear in the negotiations, if Republicans could not say to their constituents, we are simplifying regulatory burden on businesses, they were not going to be on board. It was super clear. And so so we did this and we crafted it in a way to do that under the principle, no double jeopardy. If a fuel is subject to the fee, it should not be subject to the regulations for the reason for which it is subject to the fee. And let's craft it very narrow. And the Republicans we were working with that, yeah, that's okay. This should be narrow because we are interested in protecting our environment. We are interested in clean air and clean water. And we don't want double jeopardy. We don't want duplication, but we're fine with the integrity of the system. And so what the text says is this. Notwithstanding subsections A and B. Now, subsections A and B are the subsections that put the pause on regulatory authority. Nothing in this section limits the administrator's authority pursuant to any other provisions of this act. One, to limit the emission of any greenhouse gas because of any adverse impact on health or welfare other than its greenhouse gas effects. So the EPA can still regulate greenhouse gases if they are making people sick, or they can regulate it on welfare other than its greenhouse gas effects. So, for example, if you have a fracking site and the greenhouse gases that are coming out from that fracking site, they are sickening the people who are close to that fracking site, even though those are greenhouse gases, you can still regulate those greenhouse gases based on their negative health impacts on the local community. So that's just saying you can still regulate, it's a scalpel, it's not a cudgel. Number two, in limiting the emissions as described in paragraph one, to consider the collateral benefits of limiting the emissions because of greenhouse gas effects. So an important function that the EPA does is it says, what is the cost-benefit analysis? So by reducing these greenhouse gas emissions, what are the benefits we are achieving by averting this cost in the environment? And it could be conceivable that this legislation could have handicapped the EPA in saying, in accounting for those benefits. But this is saying explicitly, no, the EPA can still consider collateral benefits and limiting the emissions because of the greenhouse gas effects. So you can still account for the real savings society achieves by not emitting these greenhouse gases. Number three, to limit the emission of black carbon or any other pollutant that is not a greenhouse gas that the administrator determines by rule has heat trapping properties, or to take any action with respect to any greenhouse gas other than limiting its emissions, including monitoring, reporting, and record keeping requirements, conducting or supporting investigations, and information collection. So even if you have a greenhouse gas and you can still, other than its heat trapping properties. So for example, CO2 And if you decide it's important to regulate CO2 and its effects on oceans for ocean acidification, this is saying you can still do that. You can still monitor the greenhouse gases. You can still keep records. You can still conduct information. You can still collect. The EPA can do most things. It just can't regulate these greenhouse gases for the greenhouse gas effects. Everything else is okay. And so another way that I like to explain this whole section is if you have, say, coal, you can still regulate it for its mercury. You can still regulate it for its sulfur. You can still regulate it for its effects on streams. You can still regulate it for its effects on waters. You just can't regulate the CO2 for its greenhouse gas effects unless burning it is making people sick locally, and then you can still regulate it. So this is very narrow. It's a very narrow regulatory pause, and of course it comes back anyway. Looking a little bit more about this, notwithstanding subsections A and B of section 330, so this is again those parts that actually put the pause on the regulations, the administrator, and this is the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, may limit the emissions of any greenhouse gas as defined in section 9901 of the Internal Revenue Code of 1986 on the basis of the emissions greenhouse gas effects as determined in section 9901 of the Internal Revenue Code of 1986 from any class or classes of new motor vehicles or new motor vehicle engines subject to regulation under subsection A1 and B. Grant a waiver under section 209B1 for standards for the control of greenhouse gas emissions. So economists have long known that a carbon fee or a carbon tax or a cap and trade system would not do so great of a job at limiting emissions from the transportation sector. And what this section does is it says the EPA can keep CAFE standards, it can keep tailpipe standards, and the state of California can still be granted a waiver so they can have stricter standards. So if you are into these details, you may know that California was granted a waiver from following the federal government's standards to pursue more strict standards for its vehicle fleet to cut back on emissions that were causing real harm. California can still do that. The effect was that California effectively set the standard for the country because one out of every nine Americans is a Californian. And so it's just such a big market that they were able to keep this. This is retained. CAFE standards, the exemption, tailpipe standards, they're all retained explicitly. Here's the text in the bill. And then the last thing that I'll cover is the no preemption of state law. And so this is literally the last thing in the bill. It just says, Section 11, no preemption of state law. Nothing in this legislation shall preempt or supersede or be interpreted to preempt or supersede any state law or regulation. And what we had in mind when we crafted this was the RGGI states and California with AB 32. So there are already states who have cap and trade systems, they have carbon prices in place. And we just wanted to say, and they like them a lot. And so thinking of the coalition we would need to actually pass this, if the federal government was seen to be saying, nope, this, you can't keep that, we could actually potentially lose people from the delegations from those states, both Democrats and Republicans. So with legislators in mind, we said, nope, you can keep those. If you want to be a state who wants to overperform, if you want to put a higher burden to achieve a higher environmental outcomes for your state, you can do this. So this is enabling states to overachieve, to make sure that legislators from those states who like those state programs can continue to take pride in those programs and reap the benefits for their citizens, the residents of those states, of those programs. So, and I think the theme of this, again, no double jeopardy. If it's subject to the fee, it's not subject to regulations, but it's very narrow, and we still want clean air, and we still want clean water. We want nothing in this bill to make it harder to get to lower emissions, clean air, and clean water. So those are the selected parts that I wanted to go over. That was a narrower view of the bill than I would go through with the legislative offices. But I hope you got a flavor for what it was like to be in these meetings, going to Democratic offices, going to Republican offices, introducing them to the bill and getting them up to speed as quickly as possible, so that they can make informed decisions and advise their bosses. So I hope I was able to pull back the curtain a little bit, and I hope you were able to work through some of the key provisions in the bill text.
So with that, because we are at the top of the hour, and one last slide is just my contact information. If anything that you were hoping to find out tonight didn't get spoken to, please feel free to reach out to me. My email is just brett@citizensclimate.org. I'd love to make sure to point you in the right direction or make sure that we can develop resources to speak to your concerns. But our last and foremost is we just wanted to thank all of you for being on the line. We are so grateful for all of the work that you're doing. We hope that you continue to come to us. If there's anything we can do to support your local outreach in drumming up the ongoing awareness for the Energy Innovation Act, and we wish you a wonderful night, everyone. Thank you again.
Thank you, Danny.
Good to see everyone.
Wonderful work.